Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Citizens Against Ruining the Environment et al. Versus the EPA et al. Ms. Bugle?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Faith Bugle. I am representing the Environmental Citizen Group plaintiffs, petitioners. I will be discussing the legal context of this case, and Mr. Post will be discussing the specifics of NSR and opacity. This case is here on the review of an administrator's petition response failing to object to deficient Title V permits. The issue is, can the administrator read enforcement discretion into Title V permitting when his reading strips away the substance of the Title V program? The court should reverse the administrator as arbitrary and capricious for three reasons. First, his interpretation of the statute is untenable because it treats the term demonstrates as giving him boundless autonomy to pursue these violations through enforcement instead of through the mandatory permitting program. Second, it abdicates his non-discretionary duties to assure that compliance with the statute. Third, the administrator failed to review the petitioner's submittal of evidence on the merits. If done, it would show that on the facts, the permittee is noncompliant and any other conclusion is arbitrary and capricious. We believe this can be decided under Chevron Step 1 because the statute is clear on its face and the administrator's decision conflicts with the statute. If we move to Step 2, Skidmore deference applies because the decision didn't go through notice and comment rulemaking, and it was an application of informal agency policy. As to the first argument, the administrator's decision reading enforcement discretion contained in the term demonstrates conflicts with the clear language of the statute. This must be looked at in the context of the Title V permitting program, and the administrator's decision does away with that program. This is a mandatory and meaningful program. The entire point of the Title V program is to address compliance at the permitting stage and not refer all violations to enforcement where resources are already strained.
Yep, I'm trying to figure out a lot of things in this case, but is there an opportunity that you have before the Illinois EPA to raise these kind of concerns before they issue a permit?
Yes. The Illinois EPA's permit process has an opportunity for notice and comment, and petitioners did provide these comments at that stage of the process.
And the Illinois EPA apparently didn't agree with that those were impediments to issuing the permits here.
This went through several stages. At one stage, we did a petition to object. It was referred back to the Illinois EPA for them to respond to our comments. And Illinois EPA did issue a response to comments, which is in the record. And in that response to comments, Illinois EPA indicated that they were not concluding that there were not violations at these plants. They did indicate that the plants may show noncompliance some of the time, but that these did not rise to the level of violations that needed to be addressed in the permit and through a compliance schedule. While that decision isn't before the court on review, there are errors of law in that decision as well, because the same standards apply.
Are the same general issues then raised when you go to the federal EPA that you raised unsuccessfully before the Illinois EPA?
Yes, Your Honor. The same issues are raised, and the federal EPA conducts a de novo review of the Illinois EPA's decision because the federal EPA is, of course, the ultimate agency in charge of the Clean Air Act and its regulations.
Then, again, I'm really just trying to understand this case because it is a little difficult. If you come in and say there are violations of the Clean Air Act that would prohibit issuing this permit, And that's your position generally, isn't it?
That's correct. Let me just say, not prohibit issuing the permit, but require the permit to be issued with a compliance schedule.
With this schedule of what percentages, during what periods of time these pollutants could be, what the level, tolerable level of pollutants would be.
The tolerable level are the limits in the permit that are taken from the Illinois.
That 20% thing?
That 30%. And that is the tolerable limit with the exceptions, but the compliance schedule would require the facility to indicate the steps that it would take to reduce these violations down to the acceptable level.
But would there have to be a full evidentiary hearings and proceedings? This is apparently a contested matter, isn't it, that the coal people say they're in compliance and say they're not?
It is contested in terms of conclusory statements by the applicant. Nonetheless, all of the evidence in the record is not contested in the sense that no evidence was ever submitted to counter petitioner's submittal. There is a process by which that can be done through the permitting process. Therefore, this does not end with a decision by EPA to object, but that would remand the permit to the Illinois EPA to begin a process via which the applicant could submit their own evidence, so a weighing of evidence, not necessarily a full investigation or full dress trial, but at least a weighing of evidence could be made to determine if there are violations. That is not the case here because the EPA failed in its duty to object and remand the permit. The EPA, it is impermissible to do so when all the evidence in the record demonstrates violations and there is no countering evidence. In addition, the evidence that demonstrates violation is Midwest Generation's, the applicant's own reports required under the permitting scheme reporting their violations. And when the exceptions are applied to those reports, there are still exceedances. By its own terms, by the applicant's own terms, those exceedances are violations because they have already applied the exceptions.
When you were unsuccessful before the Illinois EPA?
Yes.
You had appellate relief potential in the state courts or not under the administrative?
There is an avenue by which the permit itself may be reviewed before the Illinois Pollution Control Board and then the state courts. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, the U.S. EPA makes the ultimate interpretations.
You just chose not to take that appellate review route, is that right?
That's correct.
Though that's where you want us to return you to.
This process would return it not to Pollution Control Board, but to the Illinois EPA, the state permitting authority.
Whereas I understand that's where you started.
That's correct. But this process could lead to an order that indicates what the state permitting authority needs to do here, which is not and by the state permitting authority's own admission, it did not conclude that there were no violations here.
I didn't mean to raise that. I just wanted to see whether there are any exhaustion issues here with regard to not proceeding through the state channels before commencing here. That's all.
And because the Clean Air Act provides for the petition process and considers the EPA's response as final agency action, there should not be exhaustion issues. Thank you.
Mr. Post?
Thank you, Your Honor. Gerald Post, I'm Assistant Attorney General in the State of Illinois. I represent the people of the State of Illinois in this matter. If I could attempt to answer these questions.
That's sure. Pretty odd, isn't it, here, that the Attorney General is objecting to what the Illinois EPA has done?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily odd in the context of the Clean Air Act. I think it anticipated that a state would be able to object to what a permitting authority does.
Well, I mean, I would think, if the Attorney General has problems, why would you go to the Illinois EPA before any of this percolated up to the Seventh Circuit?
The process is that we can provide comments to the Illinois EPA. Once it's issued a permit, then the Clean Air Act provides this brief period of the permit has to be given to the administrator of the U.S. EPA for his review for 45 days. If he doesn't object at that point, then parties can participate and ask him to object. But we would not have an alternative route on the state system for that. Now,
kind of a formal thing you're talking about, but you're both part of the executive branch of government in the state of Illinois.
But only the Attorney General is the legal representative of the people of the state of Illinois. And while we had wished that the IEPA had listened to our comments and incorporated them, they did not.
Who represents their interests?
They are not a party to this proceeding, Your Honor.
They didn't seek to have a special attorney general represent their interest in this litigation?
Frank, Your Honor, 2 weeks ago they sent a letter requesting appointment of a special for the purpose of filing an amicus brief along the lines of what the other parties have already filed, an amicus brief which had been due 2 months earlier. That's the first that we've had any request.
This point, there has been, I assume that's the executive or the governor's office or whoever, made that request of the attorney general. The attorney general has opted not to respond, or at least at this date. Is that what's happened?
The attorney general, and this is not a public document, but I understand you may have seen a copy of the letter requesting representation, which was copied to all counsel of record here. The Attorney General has declined to appoint a special because the reason for the special was to file this amicus brief, which was already late and would have been redundant with the arguments ably presented by the Department of Justice and Midwest Generation.
Now, you started by telling us that you represent the people of the state of Illinois, but doesn't the Illinois EPA also represent the interests of the people of the state of Illinois?
No, it does not, Your Honor. Under the Illinois Constitution, it's the Attorney General that represents the people of the state of Illinois legally.
It represents maybe in the formalistic legal understanding of that term, but I would think that the Illinois EPA represents the interests of the people of the state of Illinois. Do you disagree with that?
Well, in this particular instance, they are the permitting authority under the Clean Air Act, and while I think they should have operated differently, I don't think they're representing the people of the state of Illinois in this context.
The federal EPA represents the people of the United States, which includes the people of Illinois, though, right?
It's a slightly different setup in the state of Illinois than it is in the federal system, where there's a unified executive. Here we do not have a unified executive. We do have centralized legal authority, and that's within the Attorney General's office.
Do you provide a counsel generally to the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency?
We frequently do if there is some sort of conflict with, for example, if we are representing the Illinois Pollution Control Board and the Environmental Protection Agency involved as well, that may occur. Here, Your Honor, we gave notice of our, served the IEPA with our petition back in September. And the first we heard from them was on May 12, when we received their letter dated May 8.
Is this real unusual that they're antagonistic litigation positions for two agencies in this?
I don't think that's necessarily unusual, Your Honor. There are frequently agencies are aligned against each other in courts.
Well, what agencies are aligned against each other within the state of Illinois?
In a particular litigation?
It's not an agency. That's a constitutional officer.
It is, right. And I'm not saying that that's the case here, that we're not an agency in conflict with the IEPA here. We are the legal authority. represent that. But I wanted to get back to your initial question about the process. The permit applicant has the burden of demonstrating a right to these permits, and the permits are required to assure compliance with the Act and the state implementation plan. And consequently, permit applicant does have an opportunity to present, and he's required to present all information necessary. So when we come back with the administrator level with evidence of all these opacity violations, with evidence that these 40-year-old plants may have been modified,
I want to ask
the demonstration has been made. Yes, Your Honor.
When you're talking about the evidence, is this evidence that this is an existing plant that is having opacity violations?
Yes,
and
they are.
And the permit is for additional expansion of some kind, improvements, or whatever you want to call them?
No, these are existing plants built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. There's six of them. They've never had an operating permit under Title V. Remember, Title V was promulgated in 1990. This is the first set of operating permits for these plants under Title V. Earlier, they had been granted permits under the state implementation plans, which had preceded the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act.
So these permits are for existing plants, things that have been in operation for quite a while, obviously. And when you're talking about the compliance schedule and the permit, do you want, is that prospective, things that would you anticipate, or things that are already happening?
The compliance plan is intended to grant that assurance that the permittee will be able to comply with the acts in instances where there's evidence that they are not currently in compliance with those requirements. So, if, for example, here we have a lengthy history of violations of the opacity limitation. A compliance plan would insert some intervening event so that we know that what has been happening continually right past the time the permits have been entered would not necessarily continue.
Now, what about notice of a violation? Is there something concurrent going on with some of these that would come from the EPA?
The notice of violation was filed in July of last year. It is continuing at a somewhat leisurely pace, Your Honor.
Not much happening. But that's part of the enforcement.
That's part of enforcement, and that the burden is on the U.S. EPA against the permit applicant or the facility owner, as opposed to the burden being on the permit applicant in the permitting context, which is a great distinction between the permitting and enforcement to which the IEPA deferred. I've expended my time. I'd like to declare no further.
Just one last question, Mr. Post. At the time of that initial action before the Illinois EPA, did the Attorney General choose to intervene in the litigation that Ms. Bugle spoke of?
There has been no litigation
The
IEPA.
The permit process. I mean, when there was an objection to the permit process, was the AG at that point involved?
The people did issue comments, and in fact, the petition for objection to the administrator has to reflect the same issues that have been presented in the comments. But it's a comment, and it's an administrative legislative function of issuing a permit. Mm-hmm. If once a permit is issued, if the permittee objects to conditions, then there's a right to go to the Pollution Control Board. We do not necessarily have that as an alternative here. And the Clean Air Act.
Could the state through the or the people through the Attorney General have appeared before the Pollution Control Board to make the kind of position clear that you are making currently now?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why is the people's interest reflected in this before us today? When are you saying the Attorney General couldn't have reflected the interest of the people in that permit process when it was going forward from the or not going forward with the Illinois EPA?
Well, only by the comment procedure
that's the only way.
That. Now, perhaps there could have been some sort of declaratory judgment or some sort of extraordinary means, but the Clean Air Act provides the proper means for proceeding here. I think it may have been improper to have tried to forego that. And the Clean Air Act has a fairly efficient manner of dealing with this, with the 60-day periods, et cetera. Thank you. I'd like to save the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Mr. Bonebrake?
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is T. Bonebrake, and may it please the Court, I represent Midwest Generation, LLC, the respondent intervener in this matter. Midwest Generation operates the six plants at issue in this appeal, and as noted in responses to some earlier questions, those plants have been in existence for decades. Midwest Generation acquired the plants in 1999 through an asset purchase agreement from an entirely separate company, Commonwealth Edison. Appellants claim that opacity violations have occurred while Midwest Generation operated the plant, that is after 1999. And they also claim that ComEd triggered and then violated prevention of significant deterioration and new source performance standard requirements back in the 1990s. Appellants seek through this Title V permit process the compliance schedules they contended are needed to bring the plants back into compliance based upon what they view to be violations. This case is about whether appellants may achieve the enforcement result they desire based upon accusations in this Title V permitting process, which in our view would run an end run around the Clean Air Act's enforcement process, an entirely separate process and mechanism, which would require proof and a conclusive judgment of noncompliance before compliance requirements could be imposed based upon alleged violations.
Before this permit process, what was the enforcement procedure for these existing plants? I assume there was some question of opacity before these permits came into play.
To my knowledge, Your Honor, there was no pending enforcement matter with respect to opacity, NSPS, or PSD prior to issuance of the permits.
Was there an enforcement mechanism?
There has always been an enforcement mechanism under the Clean Air Act to bring claims against alleged violators. And those mechanisms are available both to the United States Environmental Protection Agency under Section 113 of the Clean Air Act. And under Section 304 of the Clean Air Act, citizen groups, environmental groups, can bring claims, as could the Illinois Attorney General. And in fact, under the Illinois Environmental Protection Act, the Illinois Attorney General could also bring claims against alleged violators. So there are various mechanisms that are available under the Clean Air Act and under the Illinois Environmental Protection Act to bring claims to seek enforcement, including compliance schedules, for alleged violations.
And you're saying before these permits came into play, there were no, whatever you want to call it, enforcement proceedings pending?
That is correct, Your Honor. To my knowledge, that is correct. US EPA rejected the petitions to object, and the decisions of US EPA should be sustained for several reasons, and I hope to touch base on just a couple of those in the few minutes that I have today. First, the relief sought by the appellants is inconsistent with the Clean Air Act and procedural due process requirements. Second, they have not demonstrated any noncompliance that could require a compliance schedule. We take very strong issue with assertions in the briefs by the appellants and comments by counsel for the appellants today that there are violations that have been established in the record that they have compiled. We believe that no violations have been established. We do not believe that the plants are in violation of opacity requirements or with prevention of significant deterioration or NSPS requirements. The third point I just wanted to touch base on is that some claims made by the appellants are not properly before this court, including the Illinois Attorney General's PSD compliance schedule request and the claims of all appellants asserting NSPS violations, because those claims were not presented to US EPA in the objection petitions, and therefore US EPA never had an opportunity to enter a decision on those matters. There's no objection that is properly before this court with respect to those matters. Under appellant's view, they can force compliance schedules in this Title V permit process by making accusations supported by some minimal showing of alleged violations in a permit petition to US EPA. In contrast, in an enforcement action, they would be required to plead and prove what it is they contend is a violation. In such an action, Midwest Generation would have an opportunity to defend based upon a complete record of the relevant facts and the relevant law that would be developed during the course of that enforcement action. That opportunity is not present in this Title V process. There was an allusion earlier on to the opportunity to put information of record. I think what was being referred to is an opportunity of the public to comment on permits. The pre-issuance permit process does not provide an opportunity for hearing, doesn't provide for an opportunity of cross-examination of witnesses, including any that the appellants might have, to support their claims. That is an informal process by which parties can submit comments. The appellants did so. But that is not a formal process for adjudication of alleged violations.
Do you think the contracted period of time, that the 45 days or the 60 days or whatever it is an indication that there's not supposed to be this kind of detail or enforcement?
I think that is a very important observation, and I think a correct observation. And perhaps I could bring some concreteness to my answer. New Source Review, which is comprised of a couple of programs, one of which is a prevention of significant deterioration, is a very complex program. And there have been enforcement actions undertaken by the federal agency, US EPA, against a number of companies in the United States over the last several years. Those have been very complex, lengthy pieces of litigation. The earliest of those cases was filed in 1999, and we are still seeing trials today. Some of those matters are still outstanding. So what we are talking about is a very challenging process of determining whether existing sources have been modified. Unless existing sources are modified, they do not become subject to PSD or NSPS. So the whole idea of trying to go through that kind of lengthy, fact-specific analysis that requires detailed factual testimony, typically requires extensive expert testimony in a 45-day period or a 60-day period, where you don't even have the mechanisms available to bring in witnesses and ask questions and develop cross-examination. I think, yes, Your Honor, the way the Clean Air Act is set up in the Title V petition objection process on the one hand, and then the enforcement mechanisms on the other in Section 113, that dichotomy does suggest that Title V was not intended to attempt to resolve alleged violations. The appellants would like this court to enter compliance schedules to cure the alleged violations. Because compliance schedules are required under the Clean Air Act only when they lead a source back to compliance, that is, they assume violations, a ruling by this court imposing a compliance schedule would effectively resolve the alleged violations against Midwest Generation. But at this point, there has been no discovery regarding the alleged violations, no cross-examination of appellant's witnesses, no evidentiary testing of the record that appellants have compiled, and no hearing. In short, Midwest Generation has not had an opportunity to defend because the Title V permit objection process does not provide that opportunity. In fact, Midwest Generation had to intervene in this appeal just to present its position that it has not had a chance to defend. Appellants argue in the reply brief that the Illinois permit appeal process would somehow provide adequate process. I do not see how that can be. The decision appellants want from this court is that compliance schedules must be included in the permits. If that decision is issued, any appeal of the need for the resulting compliance schedule by Midwest Generation and an estate permit appeal, the appeal would go to the Illinois Pollution Control Board. That appeal effectively would be an appeal of this court's decision about the need for a compliance schedule to a state administrative agency. Appeals of this court's decisions, of course, don't go to state administrative agencies. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Mr. Oakes.
May it please the court, my name is Matt Oakes and I represent the United States. There are two things that I'm going to talk about today. The first is the demonstration requirement and the second is Illinois EPA's standing. Section 505B2 does not define the term demonstrates, and neither do any applicable regulations. So in practice, what EPA does is it looks at the record before it and the record submitted by petitioners when they petition for an objection and determines whether that record demonstrates violations of the Clean Air Act. In this case, EPA determined that the demonstration wasn't made. And it makes sense to require petitioners to make the demonstration given the time frames that are set by the Act. The Act allows 45 days for EPA to initially review a Title V permit proposed by a state permitting agency. If EPA decides that they won't object to that proposed permit, it allows the public to petition EPA for such an objection, and EPA has 60 days to respond to that petition. An enforcement action is in a separate procedural context completely. Enforcement actions are under Section 113 of the Clean Air Act. And Section 113 of the Clean Air Act allows the administrator of the EPA, based on any evidence before it, this can be hearsay evidence, any type of evidence, to make a finding that there is a violation. That administrative finding of a violation is also referred to as an allegation in Section 113B. That allegation is the beginning of the process. It's notice. And the notice tends to be more general. The NOVs tend to be more general than subsequent complaints. And the potential result of an enforcement process is something that could impact a permit for a power plant. It could impose permit terms. But that's the end of the enforcement process, after potentially a finding of liability on summary judgment, or after a trial on the merits and a finding by the court of liability. What petitioner's position would do is equate the start of that process, the initial allegation that can be based on any evidence before the administrator, with the end of the enforcement process. In other words, they want a demonstration, and a demonstration which would require EPA to object to a permit and send it back to the permitting agency to include the schedule of compliance and include those terms in the permit, to be based on some evidence that may support a notice of violation but hasn't been through the courts, it hasn't been through discovery, and it hasn't been vetted. And the process itself doesn't allow for the time to do the type of investigation necessary to make those determinations, and if petitioner doesn't meet their burden to make a demonstration, the administrator doesn't necessarily have the time and the resources in that 60-day period to make that type of determination on its own. And in this case, there is some ambiguity on the record. With respect to opacity, and I'll address opacity first, there was some evidence that there may be opacity violations at each of these six facilities. That evidence was submitted by petitioners when they petitioned EPA to object to the EPA permit. Now, on the other side of the ledger, there was the state permitting agency, which has been involved in this process for years and had decided that a schedule compliance was not necessary. Now, EPA looked at the evidence submitted by petitioners and saw, you know, there could be a potential violation here, and they went to IEPA and presented that evidence to IEPA and asked them, are you sure that no schedule of compliance is necessary? And IEPA made the same determination that it had initially. It decided that a schedule of compliance wasn't necessary. Additionally, each of the six sources involved here certified their compliance with the Act, and EPA doesn't take those certifications lightly. If they falsely certify, they can be subject to civil and criminal sanctions. And what EPA was left with was some evidence on one hand of potential violations, and on the other hand, there was the state permitting agency, the permitting agency for the state of Illinois, who said a schedule wasn't necessary, and there were the sources who were willing to certify compliance. That requires additional investigation. That requires someone to find out what's going on. And in this case, EPA concluded that the best way to conduct that investigation was through the enforcement process.
From a practical standpoint, you mentioned civil and criminal sanctions as a result of the violation. What goes on during the permitting process and even in the enforcement process? Does the plant continue to operate and provide energy and all that it's supposed to be doing?
In the event that there is a false certification?
Well, I don't know. What is there such a thing as enjoining something, pending some kind of investigation? What goes on, and as far as how does it affect operations?
I am not exactly sure how it affects operations. I know that plants can be enjoined from operation, but I think that would be at the end of a sanctions process. I don't think that would be at the start of a sanctions process.
It's after this long process of going through, I guess, both in permitting and in enforcement. I guess, eventually there's some adjudication that could theoretically at least close the plant down because of excess capacity or compliance.
That's correct, or incorporate the opacity requirements into a schedule of compliance, which is what petitioners are seeking here. That's correct, Your Honor. And this brings us to the Second Circuit's NYPARG case. EPA believes that the holding in that case was flawed because that case held that a notice of violation issued by a state agency was the equivalent of a demonstration under Section 505. In other words, the Second Circuit found that the initiation of the enforcement process under 113 was the equivalent of the conclusion of the demonstration requirement under Section 505.
In that case, the notice of violation was filed before the federal EPA made its permitting decision. Is that correct?
That's correct. In that case, there was an NOV that was filed prior to the petitions to object and prior to the administrator's decision.
And in our case, the notice was filed after. Is that
That's right. The notice of violation wasn't part of the record that the administrator considered making his decision.
So if this would take one additional step if we were to adopt the Second Circuit's approach, is that correct?
That's correct. If you were to adopt the Second Circuit approach, you would also have to conclude that an NOV issued after the administrator's decision should retroactively change the decision of the administrator.
Okay.
Unless I have additional questions on demonstration, I'm going to turn to Illinois' standing. Illinois argues that it has standing on the basis of the doctrine of parens patriae and also argues that it has standing based on its own sovereign interests as a state. There is Supreme Court precedent indicating that a state cannot assert parens patriae, the doctrine of parens patriae when bringing a claim against the United States, because the United States is considered the grander parent. It's considered also to represent the interests of its citizens, which include the interests of the citizens of the state of Illinois. That case has been, it was initially applied in Mellon in 1923 by the Supreme Court in a challenge to the constitutionality of a federal statute. And in Mellon, the court held that the state couldn't bring such a challenge. Since then, it's been applied in circuit courts in the Seventh Circuit in Hinson, in the Tenth Circuit, and in the Eighth Circuit for the proposition that states can't challenge really the administrative process under the doctrine of parens patriae. After those decisions, the Supreme Court recently decided Massachusetts v. EPA, which clouded the waters here a little. Massachusetts v. EPA did not overturn any of the circuit court precedent, did not overturn the Mellon case. It didn't overturn the SNAP decision, the 1982 Supreme Court case, where they repeated their holding in Mellon in a footnote. What Massachusetts v. EPA did is said that states, when asserting their quasi-sovereign interests, are entitled to some type of special solicitude by the courts. It doesn't really explain what that special solicitude is, and the Supreme Court ultimately found standing in that case based on the state of Massachusetts' ownership of coastal property in Massachusetts. Now, typically, and in fact in all cases according to the 1982 SNAP decision, a parens patriae standing case has to be based on the quasi-sovereign interests of the citizens of the state. Standing based on ownership is typically considered a non-sovereign interest. It's the type of standing that any private party can assert. And in the Massachusetts case, the Supreme Court ultimately found standing based on the state's ownership of the property. That ownership of the property was supported by declarations in the record. There were also declarations in the record that established that if greenhouse gases weren't controlled, that sea levels would potentially rise and it would threaten the coastal property that the state of Massachusetts owned. So that doesn't seem to be a parens patriae case. Standing in that case was based on the actual ownership of property, as contrasted with this case, where the injury to the citizens is unclear. There are no declarations in the records establishing what injuries it is that the state of Illinois bases its standing on. The only argument in the case that goes to what injury it is the state of Illinois is worried about is general. And it seems that those interests would be represented by IEPA, the Illinois agency in charge of the permitting program for the state of Illinois. It's the fact that the Attorney General has capacity to sue, in other words, they're the entity in the state of Illinois that is allowed to come before this court and argue, isn't necessarily the equivalent, and it's the state of Illinois' burden to establish that it has standing. The next standing argument that the state of Illinois makes is that they have standing as a sovereign. But typically, for sovereign standing cases, the state's interest is because the state is the direct recipient of federal action. The cases that Illinois cites in support of this argument, Davis v. EPA, the state of California had requested a waiver of a particular federal requirement. EPA denied that waiver. So the state of California was the recipient of that denial. In this case, the permits were issued by IEPA, and they were issued to power facilities owned by Midwest Power. There wasn't the same direct relationship. EPA did review those permits, but EPA didn't object to the permits. EPA's action was consistent with the action of the agency of Illinois. And I see that my time is out. For the reasons that I've just discussed, petitioner's petition should be denied. And
all right. Thank you, Mr. Oakes. Ms. Post, are you going to go first?
Yes, I think I'll take all the rebuttal.
You'll take all the rebuttal? All right.
Fortunately, I have to start with a correction. We could indeed proceed to the PCB after the permit was issued under Section 40.2 of the Illinois Environmental Protection Act. I apologize for misspeaking earlier. With respect to Mr. Bonebrake's comments about enforcement and due process rights, enforcement is discretionary. There's no reason a prosecutorial agent has to go through enforcement. It can be time-consuming. There are priorities, et cetera. In enforcement, the burden is on the prosecuting agent. Yet all the information that's necessary is with the owner of the facility. In an administrative permit process, the permit applicant has to demonstrate a right to the permit. And he has all the information. He has all the burden. What they're attempting to do here and what the IEPA and the administrator have done is ignore the congressional mandate to consider permitting to ensure that a permit will ensure compliance with the Act, and by deferring to enforcement, saying, well, we might get to it eventually, and all the burden is going to be on the citizens groups, et cetera, who have no access to the facility. I see my time is expired. I did want to address standing if you have.
You may conclude with your other thought.
Thank you. With respect to the standing, we do indeed have standing under parens patria and under sovereignty. We ask the administrator to object to this permit. He is required by statute to object if we made a demonstration. We did indeed demonstrate that these permits did not assure compliance with the Act, and we have a right to an objection. Failure to have all of the applicable requirements in these permits is going to damage our ability to enforce this Act. The first thing we're going to have to do is somehow get access to that power plant and determine which requirements are even applicable to it, whereas the permitting scheme, the intent of Congress back in 1990 was to provide all that information right in the permit so that everyone, the enforcement officials, the facility owner, the public, has knowledge of what's applicable. And the public is damaged by its lack of its right to know by the curtailing this permitting process, and the state is directly injured in that way as well.
The state's interest, as represented by the Attorney General, could you have moved after the initial Illinois EPA and brought suit?
After the comment period, the IEPA issues its permits.
I'm trying to just balance your point, Mr. Post, about this burden shifting, mm-hmm. and when the interests of the citizens of Illinois could have been initiated, and when discovery could have commenced.
Yeah, well, I think we could have gone to the pollution control bar that's more limited. It's not a full-scale discovery process at that point in time. But I think more importantly, the Clean Air Act contemplates immediate review by the administrator. Each permit issued by a permitting authority has to go to the U.S. administrator for his 45-day review. Do we appeal at that time? We shouldn't.
Yeah, but we have a federal scheme and federal statutes and obviously state statutes. There's a concern, obviously, by the Attorney General as to the environment and the opacity situation here. Yet you appear seeking to come in at this date into the citizen suit. Right? So we should read nothing into the decision to make the move to enforce the rights of the citizens now as opposed to at an earlier date.
I'm not sure I follow the question.
If a state agency is failing in its responsibilities in the eyes of the Attorney General, who has this freestanding constitutional responsibility, apparently, and you were aware of the process that was initiated, it just a decision was just not made to seek compliance or better performance by that agency.
I'm not sure what vehicle would achieve
that's why
that.
That's why I keep struggling with what the Attorney General could have done at what point, I guess, is my concern.
Right. Well,
perhaps this is your earliest point. I don't know.
I think this is clearly the process that Congress anticipated that objectors would follow, rather than through whatever state scheme might be available. And also, this is
We haven't preempted state schemes, though, have we?
Pardon me?
We haven't preempted state schemes.
No,
I mean,
no, they're consistent with federal. Right. But it's also not against the IEPA. The administrator has an obligation to object upon a demonstration. And he's not doing that. He is willing to defer to enforcement, which undoes the entire scheme contemplated by Congress. We ask that this court reverse the administrator in order that he object to the permits, send them back to the IEPA for development of permits that comply with the Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Post. Our thanks to all the counsel. And